Last week, we considered Job and the terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. In quick succession, he lost all of his wealth and all 10 of his children. And probably at some point during all of that hectic day, he might have been tempted to think, well, at least things can't get any worse. Not so fast, Job. Your terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day has a sequel, and like most sequels, it's worse. Job chapter 2 begins with Satan's personal attack, described in verses 1 through 8. On another day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" And Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There was no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. And he still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason." "Skin for skin," Satan replied. "A man will give all he has for his own life. But stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, he is in your hands, but you must spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes. The first three verses sound a little bit like chapter 1, don't they? Here are the angels. Some Bible translations will say the sons of God, which literally the Hebrew says. We mentioned last week, sons of God throughout the Old Testament refer to angels. So the angelic beings are presenting themselves before the Lord, and Satan is there. And Satan and the Lord have this little conversation. "Where you been, Satan?" "I'm hanging around." "Hey, have you noticed my servant Job? This guy's all right. He's blameless, he fears me, he shuns evil. There isn't anybody like him in the whole world. And you tested him and he passed with flying colors. What do you think of that, Satan?" And Satan says, "Skin for skin." That must have been a saying in the old world. We're not exactly sure what he means by that, but it's basically, if you really want to get to a guy, attack him personally. He would give up all of his wealth. He might even give up the lives of his children to save his own skin. But you touch him personally. You get into his physical health and watch what happens. I'll bet he'll curse you to your face. God says, "All right, that's what you want to do. I will let you, but you can't kill him." Once again, God is establishing that he is in control. Satan can only do what God lets him do. That's an important lesson we should learn for all things. Satan does not have free rein to do whatever he wants. Trust me, if he had free rein, none of us would still be living. He'd kill every one of us if he had the chance, but he doesn't. God holds that power over him. Now, Satan says every man has his price. You know, Job can have more kids, he can rebuild his business, but you let me afflict him physically, and even death would be easier than the painful agony he's going to suffer. I'll bet you he curses you to your face. The shadow of death would fall over Job so heavily that he wished he could die. I remember hearing somebody talk about their first cruise out on the ocean they'd ever been on. And this wasn't on those great big cruise ships. This was on a much smaller vessel that could feel the waves. It was their first time they'd ever experienced seasickness. And they said, "You are so sick, you're afraid you're going to die. And then you're afraid you won't." That's the kind of thing Job's going to go through. At first, he's afraid he's going to die, and then he wishes he would, just to end it. But through all this, God allows faith, Job's faith to be tested to its innermost core. Now, I want to point something out here, and it's very important. It's very clear in this story that Satan is the one prompting Job's suffering. Okay? There's no doubt about it in this case. But we should not conclude that all physical suffering comes from the devil. I know if you turn your television on and you get one of these faith healers on TV, you know, and they're casting out the demon of asthma and the demon of cancer and the demon of this and that. Everything comes from the devil. It's not. Now, to be fair, sometimes it is. In the New Testament times, Satan's demons can cause, among other things, blindness, muteness, incessant pain, insanity. But is all suffering from the devil? No, it's not. You will also see in times, in the scriptures, that sometimes physical affliction is a natural result of carelessness on our own part. We bring it on ourselves. I'm sure we can all think of times in our lives where we've done something foolish and have reaped the consequences later in our own bodies. It's our own fault. There are times when our agony can be the result of the choice of others. Other people make a choice, but we pay the price. He said, "That's not fair." No, it's not. But one of the characteristics of sin is that it doesn't only affect the person who sins. Sin has a ripple effect. And those consequences sometimes hit innocent people. It happens all the time. You know, someone may drink too much alcohol and decide to drive. And if they have an accident, you say, "Well, that's their fault." Yeah, but what about the people they hit? See, they pay the consequences for the choice he made. And that happens. That happens in our lives all the time. Some suffering can only be chalked up to original sin. When Adam and Eve sinned in the garden, they brought the consequences of sin into the world, and that includes disease, disaster, disability, and even death. And when you see a small child contract a terminal disease, when something happens that you just can't lay at the feet of anybody else, sometimes it's just the world in which we live. Sin brings suffering, and it doesn't always add up. We can't always point to, "Here's the cause." Sometimes it's from original sin. And yes, at times suffering comes from the hand of the oppressor, Satan. It is crucial to note, though, that in all of these things, God remains sovereign. God is still in control. So we can rest assured that even in sickness and suffering, God can work in all things for the good of those who believe in him. That's what Romans 8:28 promises. It's not that all things work together for good. It's that God works in all things for our good. All things aren't good. Not everything that happens to us is good. But God can work good through it, regardless of its source. Now, verse 7 records that Satan afflicted Job with painful sores from head to toe. The two Hebrew words translated sore boils were used of one of the 10 plagues in Egypt in Exodus chapter 9. Also of King Hezekiah's illness in 2 Kings 20. Now, medical doctors today have wondered, what is this? You know, they try to look at the symptoms and come up with a diagnosis. One resource thought maybe it was smallpox. Another one, elephantitis. Another, chronic eczema. Another suggests leprosy or psoriasis, keratosis. One recent one even suggested melanoma, a kind of skin cancer that would have been particularly aggressive. There's one that's in medical terms, and I'm probably not even going to say this right, pemphigus foliogeus. I don't know what that is, but it sounds bad. And in fact, that's probably what best describes what Job has. He had inflamed ulcerous sores, itching, degenerative changes in facial skin, loss of appetite, depression, hardened skin and running sores, difficulty breathing, figuratively if not literally, darkened eyelids, foul breath, loss of weight, continuous pain, restlessness, and fever. All these things Job describes throughout the book as what he suffers. Just a relentless, ongoing pain that was both visible, and it made him look horrible, and it made him feel terrible. Now, we're not sure if this was a terminal disease or not. They didn't think in those terms back then. But Satan could have chosen any chronic disease and afflicted Job with it. The picture we get is that Job is the personification of misery. Verse 8 says that he went and he sat in the ash heap. This is probably reference to the garbage dump outside of town, where the city trash was deposited and burned. Oftentimes, that's where the city rejects lived. Some of those who would have to go through the trash to find something to eat. Job was there. And here, the city's leading citizen is now living in abject poverty and shame. He was an outcast. Not probably like a leper, and I know many people thought that he had leprosy and so he had to move out of town. If that was the case, his three friends couldn't have come to him like they did. I don't think this was that kind of an illness. It's more of a self-exile. He moved himself away as a way to express his grief and accepting his new status as pretty much a piece of human trash. That's what he'd been reduced to, at least in his eyes. And don't forget that all of this physical suffering is heaped on top of the emotional pain he's already feeling from losing all 10 of his children. We're not exactly sure how much time elapsed between the first test and the second test, but it probably wasn't very long. And he's still reeling from that loss. So in complete confusion, total isolation, unbearable pain, no hope of change, sitting in filthy surroundings, removed from all the comforts of home, Job has hit rock bottom. This is pretty much ground zero. Can you get any lower than this? Unfortunately, the answer is yes, as Job is about to find out. Into this horrendous setting, Job gets some pathetic advice. Look at verse 9. Job's wife comes along and says, "Are you still holding to your integrity? Curse God and die." Now, how do we understand that? I mean, is this just one more fling of Satan into Job's face? Isn't it interesting that Satan said to God, if you afflict him physically, he'll curse you to your face, and Job's wife says, why don't you just curse God and die? Is Satan speaking through Job's wife to get him to do what he's hoping he'll do all along? Maybe. Or we might be seeing here a reaction of his wife's own misery. It's hard to live near to someone who's suffering. and to be utterly unable to do anything. And at times, our own frustration turns to irritation toward the one who's suffering. We blame them for causing us such discomfort. You know, Job's wife suggests he's already as good as dead. Why not just get it over with? And she's probably thinking in the back of her mind, you know, Job, if you weren't such a good guy to begin with, maybe our 10 kids would still be here. Maybe you wouldn't be in that state. So maybe she's reflecting some of her own discomfort and irritation onto Job. Remember, she also lost 10 children. She also lost all that wealth. She also lost her status there in her own town. So this has been a very difficult time for her too. And you know, I think there's one other possible way, and I tend to lean this way. Maybe we're reading this all wrong. Maybe Mrs. Job isn't belittling her husband or telling him to just die. Maybe this is her way of saying, Job, you've suffered enough. I don't know why this is happening. It doesn't make any sense to me. You're a good man. You've always been a good man. And you're holding on to your faith. You're holding on to your integrity. Let it go. We might speak of pulling the plug. Job, you've suffered enough. It's okay. And she probably thought the only way he could die would be if he cursed God and then God would zap him dead. Because again, that was the thinking of the time. If you're good, you'll be treated good. And if you're bad, you get treated bad. So just, you know, curse God and get it over with. Maybe there was more sympathy in Mrs. Job's voice than we give her credit for. I mean, some call her the help me to the devil. You know? It's like that old joke maybe you've heard. One Sunday morning, just before the service begins, Satan shows up in church, and everybody recognizes him, and they jump up screaming and yelling and run out of the church, except one little old man that's sitting up toward the front. And Satan walks up to him and looks him right in the eye, and the old guy looks him right back. And Satan says, "Do you know who I am?" The old man says, "Yes, I do." "Aren't you afraid of me?" He said, "I've been married to your sister for 57 years. No, I'm not." Now, we understand that Job's wife was incorrect in what she says, all right? Trying to get Job to give up his integrity, to abandon his faith, to curse God and get it over with, no, that's not the right thing to do. But maybe we have not appreciated everything she lost, everything she has felt. Rather than watch her husband waste away in pain and shame, she would prefer that God would just strike him dead and get it over with. Let's not prolong the suffering any more than we have to. But whatever prompted her to say these things, that must have added to Job's suffering. And here he is, he's lost all of his children, he's lost all of his wealth, he's lost his prestige, he's sitting out in the garbage dump. Maybe in his mind he's thinking, the only thing I have left is my dear wife. And she comes out and says, curse God and die. That had to have just added more pain to what he was already feeling. And I'm sure Satan was never closer to a smile then at that moment, when all of his demons are gathering around, waiting, hoping, I'm sure they were urging, come on, Job, say it! Say it! Curse God! We can win this bet with the Almighty. Curse God! But Job wouldn't do it. Verse 10, we said, Job replies, you are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? He didn't take the bait. And we're told at the end of that verse, in all this, Job did not sin by what he said. Now, before we get to what Job says about God, let's take a look at how he speaks to his wife. Yeah, he says, "You speak like a foolish woman." But in reality, he was treating her with sensitivity. And his statement here was actually courteous. He didn't say, "You are a foolish woman. What's wrong with you? You stupid or something?" He doesn't say that. He says, "You're talking like a foolish woman." He doesn't make it personal. And I think that he had some compassion. He's maintaining the spiritual leadership in responding to her faith, which maybe wasn't as strong as his. But he doesn't condemn her. He doesn't cut her down. And then he says one of the most challenging statements in all the Bible. "Shall we accept good from God and not evil?" One author writes, "It is not right to take the good of life for granted and then complain about adversity." Many people respond to trouble the way Job's wife did. They go through life standing at the complaint counter. They feel that God owes them an easy life and that he's unjust if everything is not perfect. So when trouble comes, they respond to it by becoming angry, bitter, and complaining against God. Job had accepted the good of life with a grateful spirit. Now he's going to try to endure the bad of life with a gracious spirit. He would take the losses with quietness and courage. There would be no bitterness in Job. In his response, Job teaches us much about how to live and how to die. Now, this is a hard lesson for some believers to learn, especially if they feel they've been promised health and wealth, or they've misunderstood God's wonderful plan for your life, that everything's going to be pleasant, there won't be any trouble. Now, believers on this side of the cross have many more examples from the Bible and church history of God's people who have suffered and endured. But think about Job. This story may be one of the oldest in all the Bible. Job didn't have that to lean back on, and he didn't have the perspective of the cross that could help make sense of what was happening. And yet out of that darkness, his strong belief in God's control shines all the more brilliantly. One commentator writes, "It is easier to lower your view of God than to raise your faith to such a height." And that's the challenge. The challenge when we face difficult days, are we going to raise our faith or are we going to lower our view of God? And I've seen many people that do just that. "Well, I thought God was great and God was good, but in the light of all this, he must not be as good as we thought he was. He must not be that great. Maybe he wants good to happen, but he's not able to pull it off. Or maybe he's all powerful, but you know, he's really not that good." We lower our view of God. What Job does is he raises his faith to match the circumstances. And once again, Job passes the test. He does not curse God. He does not blame God. He does not sin in what he said. And we might think the book of Job ought to end here. Or maybe jump right to the end of chapter 42 and God gives it all back. But it doesn't. We've got about 39 chapters or so where Job has to work through some of this suffering and some of the questions that do come to his mind. Now, a big reason for the next 39 chapters appears in verses 11 through 13 here in Job chapter 2. When Job's three friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, heard of all the troubles that had come upon him, they set out from their homes and met together by agreement to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. They began to weep aloud, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. Then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights. No one said a word to him because they saw how great his suffering was. Here's his three friends, apparently prominent men, coming from various towns in the area. They come, they want to comfort Job. Eliphaz is named first. He's probably the oldest of the three. Not only is he listed first here, but he's also the first to speak in each of the rounds of conversations we're going to read about later. His speeches are longer, and God addressed him as the representative of the others. So he's probably the eldest. And this comes in one of the most moving paragraphs in the whole book of Job. Now, we all know that these three friends ended up being totally wrong about Job. And they actually add to his misery. But at the beginning, they got it right. It says, they set out from their homes, they met together by agreement to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. They cared enough about Job to leave their own homes. Some of them may have traveled a good distance to get there. And they didn't sit in a comfortable home or even a hospital room. They sat with him in the ash heap. They went where he was. And that wasn't the most pleasant of surroundings. Because their grief was so great, they couldn't speak for 7 days. Now, of course, they made up for that silence afterward. You know, they were probably more comfort when they kept their mouth shut than when they opened it and started questioning Job's integrity. Now, one thing that probably would make sense of this also, according to the Jewish Talmud, comforters were required to remain silent until the mourner addressed them. So they may have been waiting for Job to say something before they spoke. So not only did they not speak for 7 days and seven nights, neither did Job. Can you imagine sitting there for a week, not saying a word? I mean, here's a guy that you respect, a good friend, just suffering, unspeakable pain for a week. I mean, that it gets uncomfortable in a situation like that after a few minutes, right? You know, maybe an hour or two, and, you know, wow, that's really something. 7 days and nights. They were truly his friends. They were just a little off in their theology, as we're going to see in the weeks to come. The best way to help people who are hurting is just to be with them, saying little or nothing, letting them know that you care. Don't try to explain everything. Explanations never heal a broken heart. If his friends had listened to him, accepted his feelings, and not argued with him, they would have helped him greatly. But they chose to be prosecuting attorneys instead of witnesses. In the end, the Lord rebuked him. They had to ask for Job's forgiveness. If they had just listened, if they had just allowed Job to suffer and absorb that instead of fighting back. Joseph Bailey was a Christian author. He and his wife lost three children, all under the age of 18, all of different things and at different ages. He writes, "What do we say to a grieving person? We are most likely to be helpful with an economy of words. In our contacts with people at death and at other times, it is easy to say too much, to talk when we ought to listen. Sensitivity in the presence of grief should usually make us more silent and more listening. I'm sorry is honest. I know how you feel probably isn't. Even if you've experienced the death of a person who had the same relationship to you as they have, they're going to feel differently. They're going to react differently than you do. Don't try to prove anything to a survivor. An arm about the shoulder, a firm grip of the hand. Those are the proofs grief needs, not logical reasoning. I was sitting torn by grief. Someone came and talked to me of God's dealings, of why it happened, of hope beyond the grave. He talked constantly. He said things I knew were true. I was unmoved, except for the feeling that I wish he'd go away. He finally did. Another came and sat beside me. He didn't talk. He didn't ask leading questions. He just sat beside me for an hour or more, listened when I said something, answered briefly, prayed for me, and left. I was moved. I was comforted. I hated to see him go. Job asked, "Shall we accept good from God and not accept adversity?" Because he knew that God was God, someday he'd make it clear. That's one reason why I believe heaven will be a delightful place. When we step into his presence for the first time, we'll be given that panoramic view. We'll get to see the whole picture. And then, and probably not until then, we'll respond, "Oh, that's the reason. Now I get it." God is totally and absolutely in charge. If he wipes out every member of your family, he's in charge. If he ends your business in bankruptcy, he is in charge. If the X-ray returns and it couldn't be worse, he's in charge. Please accept that teaching. How magnificent it is to find those who trust in him to the very end in this veil of suffering and say, "And may his name be praised." I don't understand it. I can't explain it. Nevertheless, may his name be praised. That is worship at its highest level. As we encounter different kinds of suffering, adversity, terrible, horrible, no good, very bad days, may we raise our faith to the level of God rather than lowering our view of him. That's what got Job through. That's what will get us through those kinds of days. Would you bow with me in prayer? Heavenly Father, we acknowledge, we understand that tough times are going to come. Some of us have endured them already. Some of us may be in the midst of them. For some of us, they are still on our horizon. It's inevitable. We live in a world that's cursed by sin. We live in a world of sinners who make horrible decisions with disastrous consequences. And more often than not, we are the ones making those choices. We live in a world where there is a Satan and all of his demons who work toward our woe. They want to thwart your workings here on earth, and they'll do whatever they can to do so. There are going to be times of suffering. Rather than us trying to avoid them or minimize them, may we accept them. Give us the grace to react as Job did, to maintain our faith and to raise our faith to the heights rather than try to bring you down to our level. Even as Job's drama unfolded before all of the hosts of heaven and hell, watching to see what Job would do, so we live our lives, not only being watched by angelic forces, but by human beings as well. Others are watching us to see how we will respond. And there is no greater testimony than when the light of our faith shines brightly in the darkest of days. prepare us now for those difficult days. If we're in the midst of them, strengthen us. Strengthen our faith. Give us a peace and a joy that will blow the minds of those who encounter us. And they're going to want to know, where did that come from and how can I get it? Go with us now, I pray, in Jesus' name.